Expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Four, three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. At least it is morning here in California. Welcome to our Friday morning Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you very much for tuning in. And one of my all-time favorite guests, going back to even before I was doing the Space Show, when I was attending conferences, getting information on writing my dissertation, is with us today, Dr. John Brandenburg. We met probably at a Mars Society conference, maybe something else, and we've been friends ever since. So John is one of my all-time favorites, but more about John in just a minute. You can call and talk to Dr. Brandenburg, and you should call and talk to Dr. Brandenburg, especially those of you who disagree with him, at 1-866-687-7223. Do remember, there are no call screeners, and be patient, let the phone ring, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. We do answer the phone during the break, and if you feel like you've been waiting too long because the toll-free number is busy, remember, we only have one toll-free number, so just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com and tell me you're waiting, and move that caller on to make room for more callers, specifically yourself. And I will do my best to do that. So again, our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Email, of course, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then you can communicate with us through our blog, which is thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right is upcoming shows. It's a menu item on the side. Click on the first show listed, which is Dr. Brandenburg's show, and that is the blog page for when I blog, when I archive this show. It's actually the archive page, not the blog page. But down at the bottom are the comment section for the archive. So post your comment down at the bottom or your question. As soon as you post it, I'll get a copy of it, and I will bring it up on air just as quickly as possible. So those are the three ways to communicate with us. However, again, let me stress that the toll-free number is our preferable way, 1-866-687-7223. I know many of you on Friday morning or Friday afternoon, depending on your time zone, listen at work, so you can't just pick up the phone very easily and call us. So therefore, you can email us, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or use the blog commenting thing. And since we're talking about our website, thespaceshow.com, when you go there, we do have a website newsletter, center right, and it has all of the details of the week's programming. And in addition to that, if you scroll down, it has all of our planned upcoming shows, so you can see our upcoming schedule. If you have guests that you would like us to consider for the Space Show, please do send me the information on them, why you think they would be a good guest, what their expertise is, and above all, if you have their email contact information, please share it. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or rapidly download these shows. On the upper left menu is an item called Support, and in that Support menu, among other things, is the store where you can buy Space Show t-shirts, coffee mugs, things of that nature. So do check it out. It is with Cafe Press, and they ship directly to you. Also, on that upper left menu is Listen Live. So I still get lots of emails from people saying, how do I listen to a podcast or an archive show or even a live show, which kind of amazes me, since if they're emailing me, they They must have some basic knowledge about the show, like at least they have my email address right. Anyway, you'll see a menu item called Listen Live. So we have the detailed instructions on how to listen to a live show, how to listen to our archive shows on our website, how to listen to podcasts, and that sort of depends on what kind of device you're using. So I give suggestions for the Apple family of devices because that's what I use. And again, if you want me to list suggestions for the Droid family or the Windows phones or something like that, I'm happy to do so if you provide the recommendations. I'm simply not familiar with those platforms. And then for those of you moving into the Alexa family and the Alexa world, our TuneIn player is embedded there. I know we need to do some logo work on it, but the TuneIn player is there, and you can listen to our podcast through Alexa that way. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please remember we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you are free to share our programs with people. And the only rules about this are don't do anything commercial with our shows, no edits, clips, cuts, no uploads to YouTube or anything like that, including your own website, and then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. And our copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of the Space Show pages, as well as our parent nonprofit, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out. If you have any questions or special requests, please email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we are a 501c3 on the center right of our homepage. You will see the support button. This is very important because your financial contributions keep the Space Show on the air. We definitely appreciate your support. I know I'm a little behind in sending out thank you notes. I'm going to work on that this weekend. But without your support and your contributions, there simply would be no Space Show. So remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift to the Space Show. And if you're a California taxpayer, you get a tax deduction as well, as we are California Public Benefit Corporation. Any questions, please check out OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We also have corporate sponsors. You'll see their banner ads going across our website. Do click on them from time to time to see what our sponsors are talking about. For the first segment of today's program, we have a couple of sponsors. So one of them is the New Worlds Conference. This is the Rick Tumlinson Conference, which is fairly young, but really has built a great name for itself. This year it is November 10th through the 11th in Austin, Texas. I believe it's part of the Austin Fair that goes on that time of year. And their website is newworlds2017.space. So do check it out. If you attend, let me know. I'd love for you to call an open line show, or maybe we'll set up a full show and have you debrief us on what the conference was about, the speakers, things of that nature. Also, we are happy to tell you that Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor. This is a 100-year detailed forecast of our future in space, including Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. Their website is thespaceplan.com. Check it out online. It's interactive, so you can get a lot more information. Or you can buy the full-size and color Integrated Space Plan poster. It is very cool. You'll want to display it. I guarantee that. And you can also get an Integrated Space Plan for your children. So check it all out at thespaceplan.com. And then finally, supporting us for our first segment of our program today is the Space Foundation. Their 34th Space Symposium is around the corner. Register today. This is the 2018 Must-Attend Space Industry Conference, where global space pros, leaders, and decision makers converge. It is April 16th through the 19th in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel. Their website, spacesymposium.org. And as I said, Dr. Brandenburg is our guest today. So very, very briefly, Dr. John Brandenburg is actually really legitimately from a very good school, a PhD in theoretical plasma physics. So he is the real McCoy, okay? He got his B.A. in physics. He has a math minor. All of that was from Southern Oregon University. He attained his master's in science in 77 and a Ph.D. in plasma physics, both from the University of California in Davis, before the days of Janet Napolitano and her imprint on the University of California. John is the real McCoy, so he has worked in with weapons and nuclear stuff. He lectures frequently. He writes prolifically. He does come up with some pretty far out ideas, like the nuclear explosions that may have taken place on Mars. But he is also known for some of his other work that he's going to talk about today, including presenting at the very, very prestigious Aerospace Organization Advanced Propulsion Conference later on in Los Angeles on his GEM theory, which he has talked about on many space show programs. John will also talk about his new paperweight that he has developed. This is his 850-page science fiction book, published under the author's name of Victor Norgaard, and it's titled To Rule the Night, The UFO War, Not in Kansas Anymore, Book 2 of the Morningstar UFO Trilogy. And 850 pages, aside by being a great sci-fi read, I've been reading through it. It's also a great paperweight or doorstop. I mean, it's like 3.5 inches thick, people. You will love it. And John, everybody read his bio. It's in full on the website. And let me say one more thing about John, because I get a lot of email because John sometimes is out on the fringe and isn't a mainstream kind of guy all the time. But John presents his ideas at very established and credible peer-reviewed conferences. I have been privileged and honored to be with him when he presented his GEM theory and his Nukes on Mars theory at AIAA in Long Beach last year to an overpacked room bulging into the hallway of his peers. That this was not just space advocate kind of people, but his peers. He was kept in the room 30 or 40 minutes late. That went over into the other speaker's time. Unfortunately, the Q&A was really high level. I mean, most of it above my pay grade because of the math and the physics involved, both in the GEM theory part as well as the Nukes on Mars theory. Not all of the people asking questions were supportive of John. So John takes the flack. He stands up, presents his ideas, and if you disagree, he will very civilly and politely engage with you and have an old-fashioned, real, scientific, engineering-oriented discussion and debate with you. He is not afraid to face a peer-reviewed population for the work that he has done, and he is not afraid to take criticisms. So I have to hand it to John. He does not believe that the blogs substitute for his communication, for his expression of his ideas and theories, or for exchanges on scientific and engineering topics. The blog doesn't substitute with John for getting up in front of an audience, taking the risk and putting it all out there, and then fielding questions and having one-on-one dialogues with people, real people, not AI. So I have great respect for John. I'm not qualified to tell you that all of his theories are right, because I'm not a nuclear scientist by any means, and I'm not an engineer, and I'm not a specialist in the GEM theory. But I really have to admire and respect John for his credibility. I've been doing this show for 17 years, and I have to tell you, it is very rare to find people who will stand up in front of an audience, express ideas that many may think are fringe, go before a peer-reviewed community, and exchange with people that want to attack and criticize him, and actually debate them civilly. John is a rare breed. And so whether his ideas end up becoming proven down the road, that I can't tell you. But I have great respect for him. Now, don't let me down today, John. Welcome back to the show.
After that introduction, Dave, I'm really honored to be on your show. It's always a privilege.
Well, we go back, you know, we go back to before I even had my PhD thesis done. And as I told you before the show started, and I also told Dr. Juris this morning, because he called me to tell me he's driving back home, and going to do his best to listen as he's driving, that before I started the space show, I would have never believed that the scientific, medical, and engineering communities of people that were so bright. I always had people up on pedestals in these communities because how bright they were with their different degrees and experiences and resume titles and all that, or papers published behind their name. But I, since doing the space show for 17 years, I am continually stunned at how potentially and in many ways close-minded this community is. And it is really refreshing to speak to people who take the risk, who will get up there and express themselves and take the flack from their peers and keep going. And you are one of those who does this. I remember I took your gem theory, which you approved me to do, and sent it to that astrophysicist who gave you a really civil but heavy-duty critique of your work. Remember that last year?
Yep.
Ethan Siegel. And you had a good exchange with him. And
Yes, I did. I enjoyed it very much.
And you're not afraid to do that. And most people think that they can use the blog to substitute for social interaction with people. And, of course, some are anonymous, not all. And many people believe that that counts, and they don't have to have any social interaction or stand up and debate one another and be accountable for what they say. And I really mean it, and now I'm going to quit praising you because I want to talk to you and interview you. But you are a rare breed, and it's really fun to know and talk to you. Also, because you are screwing with my girlfriends in your science fiction book.
Oh, my God.
And when we get to that, I'm going to blast you out of the cosmosphere for that.
Oh, dear.
So how dare you mess with my lady friends? Anyway, tell us about this conference in Los Angeles with Aerospace Corporation.
Well, this was all triggered primarily by the NASA Johnson project called the QV thruster, or the EM thruster. They were basically trying to see if they could reproduce reports that people had been, this fellow named Shayer had reported that he fired microwaves into this kind of a truncated cone and got kind of a net thrust out of this. And that defies all present E&M theory. And, you know, if you fire microwaves into a can, you're supposed to get a warm can. That's about it. Or if you have some coffee inside, maybe you can heat your coffee with it. So, but the people at NASA Johnson, Sonny White and Paul March and the other members of the team, they did just superb work. And they found that the effect was real. I visited their experiment. I looked at it myself. And I'm a veteran of many experimental efforts in this area in electric propulsion. I have my own patented rocket engine that uses water vapor as a propellant in an electrodeless microwave discharge that's vortex stabilized, so it's called the MET. And so I'm a veteran of many experiments like this, and their experiment looked beautifully clean and gave unambiguous results. They're putting electric power in and getting thrust, and they're making sure that the electric power can't contribute any forces to the thrust measurement. And I was just utterly convinced that these guys really knew what they were doing. They were real pros. And the effect, they apparently had established the effect as being real. Now, this, I've been honored by being invited to come and give a paper at this new conference that's going to be held at the Aerospace Corporation in Los Angeles. And This is the second big meeting on this. Last meeting was a year ago, so the powers that be have pretty much satisfied themselves that this effect is real. And that is a breakthrough.
But it's still not real according to lots of people that I see on the net or that I interview. A lot of people still say it's an artifact of the experiment.
Well, have they gone and looked at the experiment?
No, of course not. But
have they heard, you know, the people describe the experiment, all the great lengths that they went to make sure? The problem with running any electric propulsion device is the power feeds, because, you know, you're creating like currents repel. The current going in and the current coming out, that the wires carrying them, they repel each other with a magnetic force, what's called the Lorentz force, and you have to make sure that that is not contributing to the thrust measurement. But since that can be very easily mathematically described using present E&M theory, it's easy to figure out how to make sure that doesn't contribute. One of the best ways is to bring in the power through liquid metal contacts, using a liquid metal called galistan or a liquid metal alloy. It's like mercury, only it's not toxic. And so you can feed in the power and make sure that it's not creating any forces that contribute to the thrust measurement. And you just have to be very, very clever and good, and you have to be very critical of your own work. You have to say, well, okay, where am I making a mistake, and look for that. And that's what these the Sunny White Paul March team were doing down at NASA Johnson. Johnson Space Flight Center, and they did a superb experiment.
Can they scale it up? How do you? Because I've heard controversy on that, too.
I'm waiting for them to publish new results, but they appear to have gotten a dramatic increase in thrust per unit of power. And this is also being claimed by Scheer over in Europe, who is a British guy. Scheer is not a physicist, and he insists that somehow you can explain this with present electromagnetic theory, which is just not true at all. Like I said, you're just going to get a hot cone of metal out of this, and or if you've been thinking ahead, you can heat some coffee with this experiment. According to present electromagnetic theory, you're not going to produce any net thrust. And so, however, there are rumors that both the Chinese and the U.S. Space establishment, military and civilian, have tested this idea, and they have found that it works. The report is the Chinese have tested it in space. And so,
do you think that's credible?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Well, if you're a the old slogan from Avis Car Rental Agency was, you know,
we try harder. Right.
Because we're, you know, the unspoken thing is because we're number two.
Right.
We try harder. And the People's Republic of China is in the position of being the second superpower on this planet. And, of course, they try harder. And they're, of course, looking for things that the United States may neglect or they would have immediately tried this thing, based on the fact that they're a big power rival, and they want to make their own accomplishments in science, despite the brilliance of the Chinese population. I mean, there are so many Nobel Prize winners who are of Chinese ancestry. But all of them worked outside of China. China, the People's Republic of China, unlike Russia, has yet to have any Nobel Prize winners that I know of in physics or chemistry or engineering. So they would have immediately tried this thing as quickly as they could. I mean, everybody knows how to build one now. And so the fact that they're having a second big meeting and they're paying a major bill for this, somebody is paying big money for this, is very exciting. And so I consider it a great honor to have been asked to come present.
You have a question. Can I interject it here?
Sure.
So Ben is in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And he says, John, the EagleWorks lab that you've been referencing with Sonny and Paul March has broken up. Paul is no longer associated with it, and I don't think the lab is still in existence at JSC either. I don't know what Sonny and the others are doing, and I don't officially know if EagleWorks still exists, but my understanding is all of this came to an end, possibly with some friction, especially with Paul March, shortly after their peer-reviewed paper was published in the AIAA journal. Do you think that this impacts any of the future research on M-Drive, or did they break up because of disagreement over M-Drive results?
My understanding is they were all in full agreement on the results that they were getting thrust.
Uh-huh.
From a apparatus. They were getting thrust out of an apparatus that, according to present electromagnetic theory, should not be giving any net thrust at all. The fact that the EagleWorks effort has been allowed to kind of lapse, to break apart, meaning they didn't get more funding. You've got to understand that the national security implications of this EM drive, if it is true, are enormous. For one thing, it means that you can move spy satellites around in orbit without any visible or infrared light emissions from any rocket thrusts. And it also means you don't have to carry a lot of rocket fuel. You can carry more cameras or whatever it is you're carrying on the spy satellite. You can move the spy satellite around in orbit continuously, so no one can predict its orbit. And one of the big problems with spy satellites from way back is that various people figure out the orbits of these satellites, and they arrange, they make sure that those spy satellites only see what they want them to see. Because they know exactly when the spy satellite will be coming over, they move things into the hangar that otherwise would be out on the runway, or they bring out things and present them to the spy satellite to spoof our intelligence community. And so if you can have a spy satellite that whose orbit cannot be predicted by our adversaries, that can change orbit continuously without any visible light or infrared emissions, that is of enormous importance.
Why would that affect funding for, say, EagleWorks or any other lab?
The government likes to play its cards close to the chest in matters like this. And the last thing you want to do if a new technology is discovered is to tell our adversaries all about it in the open literature. Now, that, you know, you can say, oh, well, they could also be shutting it down because they don't believe their results. That's not what I hear. So, and I had the honor and privilege of working closely with the space program, both civilian and military, while I was in Washington, D.C. for 15 years, and they like to play, especially the military intel community likes to play its cards close to the chest. So to me, I don't see this is completely consistent with it being considered a highly important technology.
Were you familiar with the summer CBS television show called Salvation?
No. So, familiar with that.
Okay, so I've talked about this on the air several times, but they secretly discover that an asteroid is going to hit Earth, and uh-huh. it's an extinction event. And they
this is a science fiction show, right?
Yeah, and they have 180 days to figure out how to save Earth. So there's a goofy MIT fringe professor working on M Drive. And he has a really brilliant MIT young grad student.
Of course.
So anyway, to make a long story short,
beautiful, right?
They get the professor. The Russians are after him because the Russians have figured out that this asteroid is coming too. Of course, they don't tell the public anything about this. And so they have to create...
The public is the last group to be informed.
Yeah, so they have to create an M drive because that is the only way they can get a gravity tractor up to the asteroid in time to try to move it so it misses Earth, and they can't nuke it because then too many big pieces will rain down on Earth and the result would be catastrophic as well. So the
right.
show is about how they get the M drive to work, which they do, then the Russians steal it. And then they have intrigue about who's going to do it. So it's all national security. They, you know, they make the president get sick and then they fake her death, so that they put in a new president who, is part of the cabal and on and on and on.
Oh my goodness, that sounds like a science fiction novel that I wrote.
And on and on and on. And then, you know, finally, I think, you know, they had a really crappy ending because it was a series. It was supposed to be a short, you know, 7 or 8 segment,
sure.
summer session.
And destroyed everything,
and
right?
No, we don't know because it didn't get great ratings, and the ending was not what anybody thought was going to be great, and we don't know if they're going to continue the series or not because the ratings weren't so good. So obviously, M-Drive, Secret Asteroid, Russian collusion for real, Russian espionage, lots and lots of sex with the Department of Defense guy and this woman and that
sure.
woman and the MIT guy and the MIT student's girlfriend and going to Russia and murder. I mean, it's all there. But M-Drive is the hero of the saga, and the MIT student figures out a way to get it to work. But they had really good science advisors on M-Drive.
Oh, sure.
And
sure.
their visuals for how it worked and what they were doing with it were really, really unbelievable. I mean, it was as good as some of the space shuttle programs I've done, except how they got it to work. And when you talk about this has incredible national security ramifications, I think back to Salvation, which I guess listeners, if you have cable, you can probably see it on demand or whatever it's called. And boy, it was every national security intrigue known in literature and science fiction in the history of humanity was in this show around M Drive and saving Earth from the incoming asteroid.
Absolutely. Well, certainly this would also help you deal with other problems besides spy satellite orbits. If you can, you know, you could attach something like this to an asteroid and change its orbit to make it miss Earth if it was going to be a problem. So there's enormous. Well, my favorite thing is it can get you to Mars in a month or maybe a few weeks. Using just, you know, so that you can travel to Mars without a lot of rocket fuel. Once you make, I would assume you'd have to get into low Earth orbit first, and then with a regular rocket, and then go to Mars using this M drive. And this is potentially a breakthrough.
So, are you talking about M drive at the Aerospace Corporation?
Oh, absolutely. Because present electromagnetic theory says this is impossible. But if you allow electromagnetism to be unified with gravity, space-time structure, then it is possible. It's the difference between, having a submarine with its propeller inside the hull, you know, not interacting with the outside water, and if you stick the propeller out into the water, then you can push against the water. If you imagine space-time as a medium that can be a reaction mass, remember, well, people say, oh, that's impossible because space-time has no weight. You know, it's vacuum. However, space-time is tied everywhere to the masses of the sun, the earth, the moon, the galaxy. So, if, in effect, if you can get space-time, deal with space-time as it is anchored with the other masses in the universe, then it is a medium with mass, and it can serve as the reaction mass. Actually, the reaction mass is the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun locally. So this is the theory I am proposing, is that the reason these M-thruster works, I'm assuming it works, is that you can use that space-time itself, which leads to gravity, the structure of space-time, is itself, its fabric is electromagnetic. And that means that if you create an intense electromagnetic field locally, you can affect the structure of space-time, thus creating a space-time curvature, which leads to a gravitational sort of thrust. And there are many ways to test this, by the way. At the conference, I'm going to propose experimental tests of this idea. But that's the basic idea, is that if electromagnetism is just by itself as a force field, then this M drive shouldn't work at all. All you should be able to do is heat coffee with it. But if it is, you might as well expect your microwave oven to fly around
the kitchen
when you're eating your coffee. But if gravity and electromagnetism are unified, as was proposed by Einstein, then space-time itself can be considered an electromagnetic phenomenon, and your own local E&M field can interfere with that constructively or destructively and change the structure of space-time, thus inducing a kind of gravity-like thrust. And so that's what I'm working on, and based on the theory I have, this is possible.
That is
the explanation for the M-drive results.
When is this conference?
It's the very first week of November.
So it's this year?
Oh, yes.
This is
the second conference.
By invitation only?
Yep.
So you didn't apply to be a speaker like AIAA?
No, I did not.
They knew about you from the space show and invited you, right?
Someone knew about me, the secret government.
So is this based on your GEM theory that you have presented several times on the space show?
Yes, I have. So apparently someone thinks my GEM theory is worthy to put in the mix.
You have a caller. You want to give it a try?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the space show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Oh, you're listening at work. I hope that you don't get canned. I'm glad you were able to call in.
No, I'm actually off today, but
for
vacations and stuff.
Oh, great. John is a physicist. Johns that are physicists. So go for it, John.
God bless you, John.
what I was thinking about along the lines of what you're talking about is that somehow to create this sort of effect that'd be significant. I think it seems like there's a question of how, for instance, how mass couples to space-time with a basic gravitational constant, that somehow this phenomenon has to couple with a stronger constant than just inert mass does, because otherwise you couldn't generate enough energy to create the kind of effects we're talking about, I think.
In my theory, and all I can do is, and by the way, my theory is all over the net. Just look up GEM unification theory, Brandenburg, and you'll see many articles on it.
I have a book here, too.
Yeah,
very good.
He has your book from when you were on the show about a year ago with it.
Yeah, I actually duplicated some of your calculations on those numbers, and they really came out right. I remember that.
Run the numbers, and you got verified.
Well, I
was amazed at what you were saying, but it seems to work.
I got the value for Big G, and no one else has gotten that.
What is Big G, for those of us who don't know?
It's the Newton gravitation constant. And it is the coupling of mass to space-time, and as John has said, it's weak. It seems like it would be a poor place to start. The present electromagnetic theory in general relativity says that an electromagnetic field has an energy density, and that leads to E equals mc squared, a mass density, and then that couples to space-time through Big G. My theory says that there is another route that bypasses Big G. Now, Big G is part of nature's way of unifying gravity and electromagnetism. And, the formula for Big G in my theory that I derived basically takes charge and mass and unifies them. And that leads to Big G. It's the mass of the proton and the electron that make up hydrogen, which, when the Big Bang happened, it was 99% hydrogen in the first instant. So basically, my theory says that you can directly affect space-time structure with electromagnetic fields. And now, nature does this actually. What happens is nature actually does this because what are the fundamental particles, the subatomic particles that make up matter? They're all charged. So you're dealing with concentrations of electromagnetic field around these particles, the quarks, the proton, the electron, and that is affecting space-time, creating a curvature, and it does it through this Big G. However, in the theory that I have proposed, the metric tensor itself, which is the way you describe space-time in general relativity, is a function of a local electromagnetic field density, and that means you can directly affect space-time rather than through the Big G route. And that is why we get this M field, this EM thruster or QV thruster effect. We are directly affecting space-time structure rather than kind of indirectly through Big G.
Okay.
I can't go in. I'd love to go into more mathematical detail, but out of respect for Dave, you can read my articles. So that's how it works. We're essentially bypassing Big G, the gravitation constant, to affect space-time directly through E and M fields.
All right. So in some sense, the Newtonian constant type gravity is sort of a ground state of a sort
basic phenomenon. This is a more, this is part of a, let's say that the present understanding of gravity is that if you have electromagnetic field, that creates, there's E equals mc squared. So if you create electromagnetic field that has an energy density, and that then distorts space-time, and the constant that determines that is Big G.
Right.
Now,
it contributes to the momentum energy tensor, so.
Right, exactly. And then that becomes the Einstein tensor when multiplied by Big G. Now, suppose that little g, the metric tensor, the Newtonian gravity, which becomes the Newtonian gravity potential. Suppose you can actually write that as electromagnetism directly.
Okay.
Then there's no big G.
Big G comes in later,
but the it gives you a much more amplified effect. You know, this thing is kind of complicated, and I'm still.
I understand. It's hard to describe in the context of a popular show.
But that's the basic theory I proposed was based on the idea that. And by the way, Einstein turns out is right. He worked for 30 years to try and unify gravity and electromagnetism. He was convinced that they could be unified. They're both the long-range forces of nature as opposed to the short-range nuclear forces. He said, we can concentrate on this as a pair. And he said this is somehow related to the fact that there's only two really fundamental stable subatomic particles, the proton and the electron. He called that the two-particle paradigm, hydrogen. The universe started out as 99% hydrogen. So in my theory, basically, that was Einstein's idea, that somehow the metric tensor, which is the way you describe gravity in Einstein's theory, is related to the E&M field tensor directly.
Right. They tried a whole bunch of different approaches over the years to get there.
He tried everything but the kitchen sink. He worked on this thing on his deathbed. He literally asked his friends when he got really sick at the end of his life, he said, please bring my notebooks to me so I can work while I'm laying here recuperating. So he worked furiously, even though he was really sick and dying. And then, of course, the story is that he got up out of his sick bed and spoke very excitedly in German to his nurse, who did not understand German, then got back into bed with a big smile on his face and died.
So we don't know what he said to her.
No, we don't know what he said, but he may have actually gotten the final insight just as he was dying.
Or he could have said something personal to her.
he was a man like all other men.
we just
Maybe
don't
the
know.
Same clay as all of us. He worked on that thing right up to his death. And now, I'm not going to go arguing with Einstein. If Einstein says the fields can be unified, I may disagree with how he did it or tried to do it, but I'm not going to argue with his basic premise because he was such a smart guy.
Yeah.
And, his boss was Oppenheimer, who ended up in charge of the Institute for Advanced Study after running the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
And Einstein and Oppenheimer did not get along. Oppenheimer said, why don't you work on quantum mechanics? And Einstein says, I don't like quantum mechanics. So there's how that argument kind of just went into a stalemate.
Yeah.
But who can argue with Einstein? And it turns out Einstein was right. That's my contention.
Well, the thing is here, we're getting experimental results here, which is a key factor. If you have, now, as far as the other issue that was raised earlier about potential government attitudes, it's not uncommon in the history that something will come out in the open literature that's known, but if the government takes a serious interest in it, it tends to disappear into some dark hole that nobody knows anything about except the people that are involved in it, you know?
I've heard of such things.
Yeah. So you know, if it disappears, that may be they're taking it seriously, or it may be they think it's nonsense. It could be either one, right?
I mean, either one, and you don't know, do you?
That's true.
They Uncle Sammy likes to play his cards close to his chest in situations like this and keep everybody guessing.
Yeah. The other thing I would say about that is, what little exposure I've had to these, there are people that are kind of open to looking at off the wall ideas inside those communities.
Yes,
sometimes.
They are.
And so they might try, because that's another advantage of doing it in secret. If it really turns out to be rubbish, nobody ever needs to know it, right?
That's right. You don't have to. You don't have egg on your face.
John Brandenburg, how does Dr. Woodward's mock thrusters work into this? Because he has told John Hunt and myself when the two of us were last year in his lab with Dr. Heidi Fern, that he thought the mock thrusters work was how M-Drive worked.
He may very well be right. He's pulsing, you know, he's applying a big electromagnetic pulse or a harmonic vibration to an apparatus and getting what looks like a net thrust. And James Woodward is a scholar and a gentleman, and he is a really smart guy.
Absolutely, he was.
The only problem I have is that the theory I developed works best kind of in vacuum around the apparatus. And his thing is working inside his apparatus where all of the materials are. And so I have tried to apply my theory to his experiment, and I can't figure out how to do it. So I will just say I consider him a superb experimentalist and a brilliant scientist. So I tend to believe that he has found a different... There are many paths to the mountaintop. That's an old Buddhist saying.
Right.
And look how many ways you can make an airplane. You know, you can make a helicopter, you can make a propeller turboprop, you can make a jet engine, you can even put a rocket engine on it, and there are many, many different ways to achieve flight. And so if you have a new type of phenomenon, which is the coupling between space-time and electromagnetism, there are going to be many different ways to exploit that. And I believe he has a different way of exploiting it than the QV thruster. The QV thruster works on vacuum. His technique involves kind of the dielectric and magnetic susceptibilities of materials. And I have a hard time describing that in my theory. I've kind of apologized to him that I can't figure out how to, you know, it's like somebody, I have a saddle so I can ride a horse, but if somebody gives me a Jeep, I don't know where to put the saddle. And, of course, I can't conceive of riding in a vehicle without a saddle, so I don't know where to put the saddle, so I will tell you, you know, I am working very hard to try and give good analysis of the QV thruster, but I've chosen to kind of concentrate there strategically simply because my theory is able to describe electromagnetic fields in vacuum interacting with space-time as opposed to inside a material. I will just simply say James Woodward is a brilliant scientist and an excellent experimentalist. So if he says that he's gotten these results, I believe him. Unfortunately, I've never been able to visit his lab like I did at Johnson. But and he will be at the conference.
Oh, he's coming again. Heidi and John are coming again.
Yes.
I want to go back down to Fullerton and visit him. I'm trying to get Dr. Juris to do it. Maybe you would want to come down and do a space show in his lab with Heidi and Jim. Would you be willing to do that?
Oh, me?
Yeah, you.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
I need
you were talking to the other John.
No, well, he went last year with me, but I'm not going to do it again. The first time I did it was with my friend Robert Jacobson, who's another business finance guy like me, and it was way over our heads. So we had trouble coming up with the right kind of questions and really to understand what it was. So last year, John Hunt and I were there, and John was a fabulous asset on the trip. I want to do it again.
Sure.
And so I need another physicist to, or somebody who really knows it.
Let's figure out how we can do the logistics on that.
So I either thought of you.
It was also fun to talk to Heidi Fern because she is also a brilliant scientist.
Oh, absolutely. So I either thought of you or jurist who you've been communicating with.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't do it alone, the interview would just not be sufficiently qualified because listen, I love this stuff, but I'm not a physicist. It's not my field.
Well, also, I teach physics, so I'm used to explaining things to, part of physics is physics outreach, is the ability to explain complicated new ideas to people so that they can grasp them.
Well, maybe I get, his lab is really small, but what would be really great would be for Jurist, you, and John Hunt and me
sure.
to go back down there, but John, you've been in his lab. Do you think all of...
Well, they'd all fit, huh?
Would we all physically fit? I mean, I'm sure Jim and Heidi would be probably very happy to accommodate us. I don't know that we could all fit in the room where all their equipment is. I mean, because...
Basically, it's an office that's been turned into a lab, right?
Yeah. I mean,
the lab equipment takes up a lot of space.
But, and then trying to coordinate everybody to get in there. But I want to do it again, and I want to be able to present a really high-quality educational program to the Space Show listeners, so I need help. And so you come to mind, and Juris comes to mind, and if John Hunt is free, he comes back to mind. He was really a great asset the last time I was there with Heidi and him. And then we all, we couldn't go to lunch because Heidi and Jim were leaving right after our program to head to Estes Park, Colorado for the big, Colorado lab thing with Gary Hudson's group. So we'll see. John Hunt, anything else that you want to add?
Well, I think, I'll clear the line for now and see if anybody else calls in. I'll continue to listen.
Okay, John, you understand how I have a theory that when I try to apply it to, James Woodward's apparatus, I kind of just come up with a bunch of more question marks than... simply because it deals with materials rather than just
right.
vacuum. Vacuum is pretty easy, it's complex enough. And but adding materials in there, which are, atoms and dielectric constants, magnetic susceptibilities, how do you describe that in kind of a general relativistic framework? That's a little tricky.
Yeah, it is. I think that the probably the phenomena is fundamentally the same, but it's just a totally different way to get elicited, I guess you'd say.
It's a different presentation of it, I think. That's my belief.
Say it again.
A solar sail to a chemical rocket, two totally different things, right?
Right. I mean, it's a solar sail or a chemical rocket. Both of them will work just fine, but they're...
Well, based on the action-reaction principle, but they're a totally different way to do it. And I think that's if a phenomenon is established, then I think it probably is underlying both of them, it seems to me.
I do believe that. It's the same mountain. We're just finding different routes to the top. And so it's a... anyway, but Heidi and James will be presenting at this conference. So.
Okay, great. John Hunt, did you watch the CBS show Salvation?
No, I haven't done it, but if it shows up on Netflix, I probably will.
By the way, I want you to know I wrote a great asteroid. Based on my experience in Washington, D.C., I also write science fiction under the pen name Victor Norgaard. I wrote... asteroid 2012 Sepulveda.
Yeah, we did a show on that.
What?
We did a space show on
that. Yeah, and I dealt with all those problems that, that if the asteroid gets too close to the Earth and you nuke it, you turn it from being a bullet into a shotgun blast. And so it's a big problem. Things yeah. get very, very complicated very quickly if you deal with an asteroid crisis. And in my novel, the asteroid impact zone is L.A.
Oh, well, there you go.
So, as one character comments, he says, why don't we tell everybody that this asteroid is coming? He said, because it's difficult to maintain civil order in Los Angeles even without an asteroid crisis. He says, if we go telling everybody this is going to be an asteroid impact zone, he says it will become impossible.
Well, yeah, I've come up with a way of using nuclear explosions to deal with an asteroid that's a little different. It's basically, instead of trying to blow the asteroid up, use very small miniature nukes to basically create a thrust by burying them in the
to deflect an asteroid than it is to try and shatter it.
Yeah, a small blast designed just to, and use some of the material on the asteroid as basically reaction mass just to drill down and then just create a small crater and blow it out, and that creates a thrust and then a deflection.
In my novel, that is the first thing they try, and so they have this big fireball, that envelops the asteroid, and then the asteroid comes out all bright and shiny. As it turns out, it isn't a rock, it's a bullet. It's nickel iron.
Oh, I see.
The nickel iron makes very, it had a veneer of dust on it, and the little nuclear weapon does is blow the dust layer off it, so it's now bright and shiny. And so that then they have a real crisis because
I have a radioactive asteroid coming in. Well, anyway.
Yes. Well, it's five times as massive as they thought because they didn't know what it was made out of, and then now they know. I tried to based on my own experience with space experiments, everything goes wrong. So I tried to put that element into the novel. They eventually, by the way, when they have to wait till it gets very close and then break it up, and they bring up the entire 7th Fleet and then a whole Army division of artillery to basically blast the larger fragments out of the sky to save L.A. from a bombardment by rocks. And so 50 people are killed anyway, many of them by standing outside while rocks were falling out of the sky.
Okay.
All right, John. Listen, stay tuned.
See what else comes up.
LA,
okay.
But L.A. does survive.
All right. Thanks, John, for calling.
All right.
Listeners, the line is available, and if I can find my show notes, it is 1-866-687-7223. With your permission, Dr. Brandenburg, I'm going to skip the break to allow a few more minutes of talk time to you, but I do want to thank our second segment sponsor, Orbital ATK, the global leader in aerospace and defense technology.
Wow.
And they're known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense. And then AIAA is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They're the world's largest pro society, more than 30,000 individual members, 88 countries represented, 95 corporate members. And all of us are busy helping to shape the future of aerospace every day. So check them out, AIAA.org. And if you're lucky, you will hear Dr. Brandenburg speak or people of his quality or maybe even higher quality. It's a great organization. Their Space 2018 meeting, which will not be disrupted by a hurricane, I believe is going to be back in Pasadena, California. And, John, maybe you will present and attend there as well. What do you say?
Well, maybe so.
Celestis is a sponsor. They're still the only proven provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services. And they have the Earthrite missions, which will not only launch cremated ruins of your loved one, but also your DNA into space. And these missions return it to Earth in a really cool capsule keepsake item. They're flown out of Spaceport America near Las Cruces, New Mexico. And there's one scheduled, I believe, for November 15th of this year. So if you're sending a beloved family member or someone close to you ashes to space, maybe you want to go with them. So send a little bit of your DNA up with them and share the experience, which is the best we can do. Anyway, when you go to the launch in New Mexico, you get to see the Up Aerospace Mission Control, the on-pad viewing of their rocket, the Space Loft XL. There's a three-day memorial celebration, it's really a very, very cool experience. And remember, I've done this three times. They're a great company to work with. I love the people, and it is a really great way to honor, to memorialize, and to pay tribute to someone you care about or have loved, or if you want to send your own DNA to space. So check them out at Celestis.com. Tell them Livingston told you to call them, and I'll bet you have an experience even better than what I had. They're just a phenomenal company. Brandenburg, I want to change the topic. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this, because I know we've got other things to talk about. But you have this theory where there are a couple of big nuclear bombs that went off on Mars a couple of hundred million years ago and did some damage. So you have been challenged by one of our listeners, Jim Fincannon, and listeners, Jim's latest challenge and disagreement with Dr. B is on the blog for today's show. And Dr. Brandenburg posted a reply, but to get it, you have to follow the link. I posted it for Dr. B, and it goes to his website because I did not know how to reproduce his graphs and charts on the Space Show blog. But this argument that you, the argument that Jim Fincannon has with you seems to be over nuclear test data and Xenon 129, and I guess he's reading various sources on the internet because he's not a nuclear guy, and disagreeing with you. Can you sort of explain the basis of this argument in Xenon 129 and what it really means for your theory about nukes gone wild on Mars?
Well, first of all, I want to just commend Mr. Fincannon for, you know, taking an interest in this. And also he located for me a very nice source for xenon isotope data in the atmosphere way back to 1937. And that was, and you know, by the U.S. government, and that was really a help. And now, obviously, Occam's razor makes you think, well, the simplest explanation for everything should be the one that you pursue. But in some cases, there are no simple explanations for, you know, data, a body of data. And basically, you have to step back and figure out at least what is the, it may be not a simple explanation, but what is the simplest explanation involving known phenomenon for a body of data. And that is the problem we have on Mars. We have a Martian atmosphere that has a enormous superabundance of xenon 129, and that makes it different than Jupiter from the average gases that you get out of meteorites. It makes it different from the solar wind, from Earth, and so you basically have Mars sticking out as a sore thumb in terms of xenon data. And there are other peculiarities also, which I use to base my theory on, but, you know, and it's just a hypothesis. It's a theory. But let's just concentrate on xenon 129. What does that mean on Earth when you see a big spike in xenon 129? In something. Well, if it's a meteorite, like Allende, which was a very primitive meteorite that broke up over Mexico, and it was a very large meteorite, so it provided a lot of data for people. This happened, I believe, in 1970. What's called a carbonaceous chondrite called Allende, named after the town near where the pattern of debris fell. And when they took that asteroid, or that meteorite, which can be age dated, the rock can be aged to 4.5 billion years ago. It dates from the foundation of the solar system. When you heat that and drive off the various gases, you get various noble gases like xenon, krypton are released. And at very high temperature, which means the most closely bound kind of most primordial of the gases, that fraction of the gas that comes off at very high temperature, there's an enormous spike in xenon-129. And that is interpreted. Now, that's a very small fraction of the gas in this meteorite, but it comes off at very high temperature, meaning it's very strongly bound, was kind of part of the original rock particles in the solar nebula. When you see this big spike in xenon-129, this is interpreted as due to what's called R process, which you can look up on Wikipedia, which is due to supernova. So this is interpreted as being the result of supernova explosions. Now, in a supernova, you have all sorts of processes going on. R process means very rapid, intense, high-energy neutron bombardment. And so in a supernova, you're making uranium, and then you're also splitting it because of this rapid bombardment of materials by the intense neutrons when the supernova explodes, which is essentially a giant nuclear explosion. The only phenomenon we have that is similar to a supernova is a hydrogen bomb explosion. And so the two communities basically both work on the same thing, or in fact many of the community members work on hydrogen bombs during the week, and on weekends they work on supernova. And basically that's where we get, you can see that in the situations of supernova, or let's say an intense nuclear explosion, you get a big spike of xenon-129. And that's in the open literature. And so we see that in meteorites, and it's also in the references I put on my webpage to explain this. Now, on Earth, if you look at the change in our atmosphere in xenon isotopes since 1937, there had been no nuclear reactions, nuclear reactors run, and there had been no nuclear weapons. And by 1937, nuclear instrumentation was very good because everyone was starting to work on nuclear isotopes. So, people had gotten very good at measuring isotopic abundances by 1937, just before World War II. Now, if you compare those to the measurements in 1978, they show a big spike in a big change in the Earth's atmosphere, on the order of a few percent of xenon-130, which is a kind of an isotope that doesn't get affected by these things. And so you've had a change in the Earth's atmosphere with an increase, a big increase in xenon-129. And you ask, where did that come from? No one disputes that that is present in the data. Then you ask, why is that present in the Earth's atmosphere? Well, it's present because of intense nuclear explosions like supernova, nuclear weapons being set off in open air. And also because of plutonium production, which uses fast neutrons in special reactors. And don't ask me to parse out how much is due to plutonium production and how much is due to nuclear weapon detonation, because I don't know those numbers and I don't care to speculate on them. But I do know that the Xenon-129 is a signature of intense, fast neutron bombardment of fissionable materials, uranium, thorium. So, on Earth, we know where the Xenon-129 comes from, and in the meteorites, we have a good idea where it comes from. It's from a supernova explosion. On Earth, it's something like a supernova explosion. Now we go to Mars, and we have all this Xenon-129 that makes it different from any other planet or solar system reservoir. What caused it? And what known phenomenon can cause this? Well, there was either a supernova on Mars, or there was a very massive nuclear explosion of some type that looked like a supernova on Mars, or looked like a nuclear weapon. And I will make no apologies for the fact that I have always thought that the artifacts seen on Mars can be interpreted as archaeology dating from a past epoch on Mars where it was Earth-like. So then you find then signs that perhaps massive nuclear explosions like a supernova or like a nuclear weapon, and we know it was not a supernova. There was no supernovas on Mars. So, and the amount of this xenon-129 enhanced that is present in meteorites is very tiny. It only gets released at very high temperature. So you can't imagine a shower of meteorites causing this. The meteorite, the basic xenon isotope profile for your average meteorite or all the meteorites that are known looks just like Earth's atmosphere. It's got a peak at 129 and a peak at 132, and those peaks are equal. But on Mars, there's 2.5 times more xenon-129 than there is xenon-132. It makes it completely different from any other solar system reservoir.
Now,
so, that's you know, there has to have been a violent nuclear explosion on Mars involving fast neutrons. It looked like a supernova, but we know it wasn't a supernova. What's the other known phenomenon? That's a nuclear weapon. That is the only other known phenomenon that can cause this kind of xenon-129 spike. So,
okay, so Fincannon says it takes millions of years to produce xenon-129, so...
I'm just saying,
he says this, he says it's not reasonable to wait millions of years to detect it, and that wouldn't explain it in Earth's atmosphere anyway. I mean, you read his note. What do you say in response to it takes millions of years to produce it?
It doesn't take millions of years. Xenon-129 is produced naturally every time there's a fission of a heavy nucleus. It does also produce some iodine-129. On Earth, we set off a lot of nuclear weapons, and it made a lot of xenon-129 immediately, promptly, as they say. And it also made a lot of iodine-129, which will decay in 16 million years to xenon-129. On Mars, it all goes in the same bag, because whatever happened on Mars happened probably 100 million years ago in that time frame. So when you fission atoms with fast neutrons, you get a whole spectrum of atomic weights, and a lot of it, the xenon is produced promptly in stable isotopes. You produce radioactive isotopes when you fission things, but you also produce stable isotopes, and a lot of it is done promptly. And you can see that in the literature.
So your website page, which I posted on the blog in response to Jim's comments, is an answer with graphs and charts
right.
to
yeah.
the
I,
critique.
I basically just responded to his thing that it's got to be 120. He's asking me basically why is the xenon 129 on an Earth's atmosphere disturbed, and that's because you know on Mars if a bomb went off and it made iodine 129 it would have all decayed by now into xenon 129 anyway. So all he's really asking is why is Earth's atmosphere got a bunch of 129 xenon 129, and that's because fission makes xenon-129 promptly, in addition to making radioactive iodine-129.
You have a caller. Let's see if it's relevant to this discussion.
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Go for it.
John, what are the sources of our measurements of xenon-129 on Mars?
Oh, the Viking, it was first picked up by the Viking landers in 1976.
And so can we really have confidence that those measurements are reliable?
Yep. They were considered very reliable. They were, I mean, they published everything in the scientific results of the Viking expedition, and it was all peer-reviewed, and it was the best we could do in 1976. Now that's since then that has been also verified by the they have a atmospheric mass spectrometer on the I believe it's the Curiosity rover, the one at Gale Crater, mm-hmm. and that's been recently published, and it verified that the Viking measurements were very good.
Okay, because we are talking about
the U.S. government,
right?
The U.S. government has known that Mars was the site of some big nuclear explosion since 1976.
You know, for most of this, I sort of have to stay on the sidelines. You know, I can ask simple questions about measurements.
Oh, sure,
but,
sure.
I do have to take issue with any possible interpretation of something looking like it's crafted by an intelligent species in terms of the archaeology.
Yes.
It's so easy to find images of things. The human mind finds patterns. You know, the face on Mars. I don't know what in particular you're thinking of, but...
One at a time, please. Go ahead, Kim.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, I just wanted to ask him what examples he's thinking of in that, because I haven't seen any example of something shown in any real detail on the Martian surface that looks to me like it was crafted.
Oh, well, I am speaking of the face at Cydonia and the nearby pyramid, or what looks like a nearby pyramid.
So
you can look up D&M Pyramid at Cydonia, and or look up Viking frame 70A13, it shows clearly here's the face, and here and within 5 kilometers, here is what appears to be a five-sided pyramid. I regard that as pretty compelling.
But what about all the subsequent pictures from other Mars missions and things, and Michael Mallon's work and others' work that totally refute all that and just say it's rock formations?
I don't regard it as any kind of refutation. Mike Mallon and his group did everything they could to make sure the picture was unrecognizable to the public. They took the picture at an oblique angle and they didn't give it any contrast. It was the poorest picture from Mars ever published. And they did it deliberately so that no one would recognize that there were nostrils in the nose. Now, any object that's been sitting out in the Martian environment for tens of millions, maybe 100 million years, is going to be eroded. The same climate that allows life on Mars also causes erosion, just like on Earth. All archaeology is eroded. So the idea that you're going to look at something that they, let's say hypothetically there was a dead civilization on Mars, if that existed when Mars was Earth-like, which is probably about 100 million years, 200 million years ago, it's not going to be pristine. it's going to be eroded. And so it's basically an argument. This is almost a research test, kind of, you know, what does this thing look like? I look at it. I see compelling evidence of archaeology that's eroded. But other people say, oh, I don't see anything. So I would look up Viking frame 70A13 that just shows the face and the pyramid right next to each other. And to me, the whole argument is summarized by that picture.
So you reject the subsequent findings, conclusion, literature, all of that?
I utterly reject it simply because Mike Malin obviously tried to obscure the true meaning of the new picture he took. He published it. In fact, they published it right, left, reversed. They took the picture from an oblique angle, so the instead of taking it directly from above like the Viking pictures, which everyone expected him to do, he took it from almost a profile, and he also took it in morning light, which everything from the Viking pictures had been in the afternoon. So there was very little ways to... all I can do is you can go to my website and see all of the recent pictures of the face of Cydonia and the pyramid. And when you see a gallery of the new pictures, some of them from Odyssey spacecraft, it still looks just like it did to the Viking. The Malin pictures basically also show ornaments on the forehead and of the helmet kind of structure, and or what we would call a helmet. It was archaeology, and also nostrils in the nose of the object, which couldn't be predicted based on the Viking images. So I regard Malin and his whole operation as being misinformation.
I'd like to reference back
to the
discussion of... get back to... I don't know if we want to keep on going on to...
We basically exhausted that subject.
Okay. I just want to... just as a complete outsider, but when people start talking about unification theories and my very simple interpretation of what you're talking about, does this have an impact on very large central concepts in physics, like, for instance, entropy?
Yes, it does, Kim. One of the interesting implications of the theory is that entropy is present at the subatomic level. And one of the easiest ways to see that is that in my theory, and I've already published this in referee journals, is that you can get the mass of the proton by assuming that this is a model of the proton with quarks moving around in it and what's called the chromodynamics. Are you familiar with that?
Chromodynamics, no, but I have heard a bit about the other.
Yeah, it's the quarks. The quarks are banging around the proton. Has about the same size as what's called the classical radius of an electron, only it's got three quarks inside it, and they're constantly moving around in there at close to the speed of light. They have what's called different color charges, and the charges are actually changing colors as they move. And so basically what you have is a completely entropic situation inside the proton. And we know how to describe a field like that. It's called the Planckian. It's the black body Planckian field, one of the earliest results in quantum mechanics. And when we do that, we can actually get the mass of the proton from that model to within a few percent.
Interesting.
Yeah. Oh, well, it basically says that the movement of the quarks inside the proton and, of course, the neutron is so disordered and chaotic that it becomes entropic.
Huh.
It's at least to good numbers. And in fact, the nice number that falls out of it is that the ratio of the electron mass to the proton mass is almost exactly 6 times pi to the 5th power. It's a very interesting result. And that falls out of the Planckian model of the fields inside the proton.
And when pi appears, is that significant? It tends to be.
Oh no! Your pi appears because of the way you sum the different modes in a thermal field inside what's called a Planckian blackbody. And yeah, pi falls out of that equation because of the way the mathematics. Turns out it's exactly pi to the 5th times 6.
It just, my reaction was, made me think back to being a teenager and being upset about hearing about the coming heat death of the universe. And when people talk about, I've heard this in regards to M drive and Mach drive, that essentially it's working because it's borrowing momentum from other parts of the universe.
Sure.
That teenager in me says, can we get around heat death then?
Will the universe die of cold or die of fire is what you're asking me. And normally when people talk about heat death of the universe, they say everything will get real cold, the stars will all burn out, and the universe will be cold and dark eventually. And unless it implodes gravitationally, and then it will die of fire because everything will get really hot. So, don't know. Perhaps.
I guess it's just the all bets are off emotions coming out.
I think so. I think we finally run into the ultimate unknowns of physics and having to do with fate.
Not,
I guess is the best way to say it.
But not in our lifetime.
No. No. So I hope that helps him.
It makes for a great show. I have to say at least that much. And you do have a way of explaining things that gives me some insight.
I may not have informed you, but at least I've entertained you.
Oh, definitely.
Kim.
And I like you mentioning the Lorentz force, that you have to compensate for that when you're doing experiments regarding M drive.
Yeah, Lorentz force.
Yeah.
What you have to do is make sure that is not affecting the experiment.
Yeah.
And that you have to be very careful. And but you can do it. One of them is to have all of the power contacts through liquid metal so that it can't really transmit forces.
Interesting.
Yeah.
See, like little fun things like that come out when you start talking about it. That's very interesting.
Yes. Little puddles of mercury or mercury-like metal.
Okay, well, I'll clear the line, but thanks for your answers. They were quite detailed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim, for calling in. And your good questions.
Listeners, the line is available for anyone who wants to talk. We'll go overboard a little bit here. 1-866-687-7223. John, is there any way to scientifically confirm nuclear explosions on Mars without putting feet on the ground?
Oh, well, you could send probes that were... You could bring back samples for Mars. You could send rovers to the sites of the sites of the two nuclear explosions I've identified. You could send rovers there to do a lot of careful tests, some of which would be classified.
What do the big thorium deposits on Mars indicate about this?
Well, thorium is much more abundant than uranium, three times more abundant. And if you want to build a really big bomb, you basically spike the uranium, you mix the thorium in with the uranium, and when you set off a hydrogen bomb, and by the way, almost all hydrogen bombs in the arsenal use this effect. What they do in a modern hydrogen bomb is they wrap the hydrogen bomb with a casing of ordinary uranium. Mostly, you know, uranium-238, which is considered inert. And you can do the same thing with thorium. And what happens is when the hydrogen bomb goes off, it releases very high energy neutrons. And those neutrons are so powerful, they actually split the uranium-238 and thorium. Instead of just splitting uranium-235, which is kind of considered the standard nuclear fuel, or plutonium, you can actually split quite ordinary uranium and or thorium. So if you want to build a really big bomb and drop it from outer space, you go to the asteroid belt and scrape a bunch of uranium and thorium out of the asteroids and build a bomb with it. And the uranium and thorium are chemically similar, so they occur together. So you just basically take uranium-thorium ore and process it into metal, pack it around this giant hydrogen bomb, and boom.
Is that what North Korea is doing?
Yes.
Do you think we know that for sure, or just based on what they say?
There are ways of figuring that out, yes.
So you think they
probably... One thing to do is look for a lot of xenon 129.
Yeah, but who's looking for it? Or it's not being produced.
People I know.
It's not being told to the public or reported to the public.
No. They just tell you how many kilotons. It was 200 kilotons.
And
the hydrogen bomb.
And the South Koreans said they put a sniffer over there, and they did pick up xenon, but they didn't say anything about the isotopes.
They didn't say which isotopes. Well, once again, this is a case of Uncle Sammy liking to play its cards close to the chest. It doesn't say, they don't say, we're looking for this or this. If you tell people you're looking for this or this or isotope, then somebody who has a nuclear reactor can actually make a batch of it and release it and make you think that they've set off an enormous hydrogen bomb when they didn't. Why would anyone want to do that?
So you would think they did set off a hydrogen bomb.
Oh, well, the seismic signals were pretty unmistakable. It was, in fact, it looks like it was bigger than they almost collapsed this mountain that they tested it under.
Uh-huh.
It probably was bigger than they thought it would be. One of the first hydrogen bomb tests the United States did was 2.5 times more powerful than they expected. It caused a lot of trouble.
Switching topics, let's go to your sci-fi book. Unless you want to tell us something else about physics that we haven't talked about yet.
No. I basically let's just say that for the normal listening audience, I've basically described the GEM theory about as well as it can be described right now.
Is your paperback book that you published a year or so ago, is that still available on Amazon? Is it still current as far as what we're talking about today?
Well, I have moved on from that. The theory, if you look up GEM unification theory, you will see my more recent articles. I don't want to just go to Mars with this theory. I would like it to be a fully developed theory of subatomic particles and fields. And so the most recent article shows that the same, one of the results of the theory is it gives you the mass of the proton out of the vacuum. And once you do that, it turns out you can get several other particle masses to very high precision, one of which is the pion, which is what carries the strong force, and the other is the W and Z particles, which carry the weak force. So this theory is becoming, is now explained the short-range forces of nature in a very, the theory is very rudimentary. I mean, it's people are looking for a Cadillac with a flashy chrome trim. No, this is just a Jeep right now. This theory needs a lot of development. So I've just basically, in fact, I told one person, I said, I've landed on a strange new planet, grabbed up some rocks and plants, and gotten back in the spaceship and blasted off. I haven't explored it much at all. It's a rudimentary kind of out of the starting gate kind of theory right now.
Okay, and you got a question before we go to the sci-fi book from from another John.
Another John.
This one Fremont John, because he's in Fremont, California. He says, on a different topic, any news on the fission-fusion hybrid reactors?
People continue to be interested in that. I mean, a lot of really smart people, you know, Sakharov of Russia proposed, kind of was one of the earlier proposers of that, and Hans Bethe was a big proposer of it in this country. He was a Nobel Prize winner. So that has really, you know, it's slowly moving ahead. The only problem is the fission people don't like the fusion. The fusion community and the fission community normally do not speak to each other. They are occupied different wings of the building at Department of Energy, so they don't even eat in the same lunchroom. And my experience has been, since I'm a fusion guy, I would try to get my fellow fusion scientists interested in hybrids, and they would all just fall silent and frown and fold their arms, which is the Korean symbol of saying no, by the way. So the pure fusion types don't want to talk about hybrids at all. So there's essentially a cultural problem in the energy research community that makes the fission and the fusion communities not want to talk to each other. And therefore, you can't get a lot of progress on hybrid yet. But I hope to change that.
Okay. So not much more to report at this time.
Not much more to report at this time, unfortunately.
The UFO war. Who's at war?
Well, let's just say, you know, I mean, science fiction deals in the realm of what if. And let's say, what if there was a Roswell crash, and, you know, the government then became aware that we were not alone in the universe. But you got to remember that what was stored at Roswell, all of the nuclear weapons on Earth were stored at Roswell. And not only did one, supposedly from the folklore about Roswell, I'm just talking folklore, 70 years ago, somebody came down and was apparently spying on the entire nuclear weapon stockpile of the human race, all five nuclear weapons stored at Roswell. And they lost two ships in one night doing this. Not just one crashed, but two crashed. And that, to me, as a storyteller, I'm part Irish, you see. So, you know, this lends itself to a very interesting science fiction scenario that we're not only not alone, there are other people out there who have may have hostile intentions. And but they don't have as much power as people would imagine them to have. Imagine somebody who comes here 400 light years, they have warp drive, but they get here and they crash, they lose two ships in one night on a very high importance intel gathering mission. That tells you a lot about a real life kind of sounding, you know, a realistic scenario is that not only is intelligence found elsewhere in the universe, but so is hubris. So is all of the human frailties, incompetence, gross stupidity, big power politics. So I tried to capture that in a novel, and basically I took all of the UFO folklore I could absorb, including from the halls of some interesting buildings in Washington, D.C. You know, I heard a lot of interesting stories, and I tried to put them all in this, what is a trilogy of novels. The first novel was Morningstar Pass, The Collapse of the UFO Cover-Up, where two women news anchors who want to be taken seriously as journalists, instead of just as pretty faces reading the news, they managed to bring down the UFO cover-up because they're both very smart and very tough and very brave. And they bring down the UFO cover-up in the first novel, especially Cassandra Chen, the kind of lead heroine. And when they bring it down, it leads to an explosion of violence in Washington, D.C., which they did not anticipate. They thought there was going to be some Senate hearings and some trials and some people would go to prison or something for lying to the public. Instead, there is an attempted coup d'etat by a secret government that's backed by the aliens. There's tank battles on the Washington Mall between the National Guard and forces from the Pentagon loyal to Congress and forces of the secret government. The aliens are supposed to show up in the sky to give shock and awe, but it's cloudy. No one can see them. So I tried to put in what you call the friction of war, the friction of reality into this novel, the first novel. Now the second novel is the aftermath of the collapse of the UFO cover-up. Because in the first novel, the blonde Pamela, she got badly wounded and is left, you know, still hospitalized. And after the coup, she almost dies during the coup, but she manages to pull through. And the Cassandra Chen character, the chief heroine, she gets captured by the secret police of the during the failed coup d'etat. She's captured, and the secret government forces retreat to this alien base in Colorado at Morningstar, and she's held captive there before they storm the place. The government storms the place and rescues. She's rescued by special forces. And so she, in the beginning of this second novel, the sequel, we are basically at war with aliens from outer space, and they're very unhappy that the UFO cover-up has collapsed, and they're showing us that. And the chief heroine wakes up in the hospital, in the hospital room that she shares with her friend Pamela, and she can't remember anything. She has traumatic amnesia of all of everything that happened really after the first Senate hearings where the UFO cover-up was kind of exposed and collapsed. She can't remember anything. And what I tried to do was present the female hero as a human being, not as some superhuman person at all. And you know, I've known a lot of people who've gone through really horrible situations, and and they often they can't remember what happened. And so, but she tries to, she feels that in order to get well, she has to remember what everything that happened to her. And one thing she discovers is she experienced missing time while she was a captive. I mean, it's not just that she has amnesia. She has an episode of missing time that even under Pentothal, she goes under Pentothal treatment to relive everything, even though her psychiatrist tells her, you know, it may not be a good idea. She does it anyway because she wants to get well, and she discovers missing time in her experience there. So I at the same time, I portray a government that has achieved some limited mastery, some limited ability to duplicate alien technology, and is now finds itself in a war with them. Also, by the way, we're at war with only one group of aliens. There's dozens of other groups out there that are watching this whole thing unfold, and they're getting very, very nervous as this war continues. So I try to, here's a historical analogy I used. The Spanish conquistadors conquered Mexico, and then they actually went to the Pacific coast. This was some of the same guys who had worked with, you know, had been part of Cortez's expedition. They went to the Pacific coast of Mexico, and they built ships, and they sailed across the Pacific and conquered the Philippines. Same guys. And that's why the Philippines has kind of a Latin character. And once they conquered the Philippines, which was pretty much just Stone Age tribes, they then found out about this place called Japan to the north. And they sent expeditions up to Japan to see if they could take over Japan like they took over Mexico and the Philippines. And, of course, waiting on the beach for the Spanish were these people called the samurai. And not only did the samurai have steel and horses, things that the Aztecs didn't have, but they'd also recently acquired gunpowder. So they had a few musketeers mixed in with the archers and the swordsmen of the samurai. So those people were waiting on the beach for the Spanish to arrive and trying to plant the flag of the King of Spain. And so the Spanish failed. They basically concluded very quickly that Japan was too far away from Spain, it was too advanced, and it was much too warlike for them to hope to conquer militarily. So they tried something else. They tried to convert large areas of Japan to being Catholics so that they would basically surrender to the Spanish as fellow Catholics. And that was discovered by the Japanese shogun, Lord Terunaga. And he brutally forced all of the Japanese Christians to convert back to being traditional Japanese Shinto or something, or be killed. And he drove all the Spanish out. And so I just wanted to present a scenario where just because somebody has vast abilities of technology, vast technological advantages, if they can't bring enough force to bear, then the locals, in this case the Japanese, then have a fighting chance against them. And that's the kind of scenario I posited in the book, just because it's an interesting scenario. It's not like Independence Day. It's more like... more like World War II.
So that's the premise of your book, is that Earth is fighting the technological superior ETs, but that doesn't mean the ETs do us in.
No, no. Remember, this is the I've written a trilogy.
Right.
This is the second book of the trilogy that's being published. It's far more complicated than that. For one thing, not only are we not alone, the little short gray aliens, the grays in this novel, who are the chief villains, are actually working for somebody else. There are other groups of aliens. You know, the universe is a big, complicated place in my novel. And we're at a strategic place in the galaxy, as it turns out, in a kind of neutral zone. And this is the scenario I posited. So that's why, you know, the idea that many different species could visit here is because nobody claims this area of space, but here we are. And, but just like the Japan, we're accessible, but there are many different players. One of the reasons Lord Terranaga, remember there was a miniseries called Shogun,
right? Several years ago,
it told embellished story of this Englishman who ended up in Japan, and he became a close advisor to the Shogun. And he told them, you can't trust the Spanish. They're going to try and conquer this place if you let them. And he was one of the main reasons the Shogun decided to drive out the Spanish missionaries. And so basically I've tried to present a scenario that kind of draws upon UFO folklore. And, I talked to a lot of people who felt they were abductees what were their impressions of the aliens. And I tried to put that all in the novel to make it kind of, and there's also the fact that it's been 70 years since Roswell. Anybody who was really hostile, let's say there was somebody who was really hostile out there, they haven't been able to bring enough firepower here to take over the place like Independence Day. They just like the Spanish could arrive with ships with cannons on them, with compasses, with fancy navigation, all of this fancy technology, you know, that was far in advance of anything in Japan. Japan basically didn't have ships that could go anywhere more than 10 miles from the shoreline of Japan. And here's the Spanish. They've sailed all the way around the world, and they arrive with these ships with cannons and things like this. But they can't land on the beach and take Japan. They can't do it. They don't have enough stuff. As Stalin said, quantity has a quality all its own. I tried to create a human drama of what it would be like for a UFO cover-up to collapse and a war, interstellar war resulting, that doesn't just involve the humans and the little gray aliens, but all these other species surrounding that look on this with great alarm and nervousness. That, you know, it's become an interstellar war. It was supposed to be a little quiet murder in an alley, and instead it's become a gun battle in the street. And also, of course, the very I tried to put in the very human story of what it is like for the two heroines, particularly the chief heroine, to try and recover from what had happened to her. And try to, she has kind of basically trauma-induced amnesia, and which happens to a lot of people. And she has to try and, she forces herself to try and recover from that. in order to, I mean, she finally tells her friend Pamela Monroe, she said, "I started this war, and I'm going to finish it. And I have to get out of this hospital to do that."
Have you written the third volume yet, or is that to be written?
The third volume is already written.
So when are you going to release it?
Oh, that'll be probably about 6 months.
So you know how all of this ends.
I know how it all turns out, and I'm not going to spoil it for everybody. And I will say at the end of this novel that I have published, the United States lands the 1st and 2nd Marine Divisions and the 101st and the 82nd Airborne on the moon. We invade the moon. And a week later, the Russians land 4 divisions on the moon. And the moon is where the alien bases are on the far side. And they're heavily defended, but now it's a ground war on the moon. And of course, a space war in the space around the moon. And so I tried to make a rather what I consider to be. I also read all these reports of what it was like to go up in a jet fighter at night and try and shoot down a UFO because you're being ordered to do that. And you know your chances of coming back alive are very low. And yet these fighter pilots would do it anyway.
Is the book available on Amazon?
Amazon.com, yep. And I'm very proud of it. And I would simply, without spoiling it, I will say that both heroines do recover by the end of the novel from the psychic and physical injuries they suffered, and the as I said, the United States and the Russians invade the moon, the front side of the moon. They land. It's basically a Normandy-style invasion on the front side of the moon.
Listeners, as I said, starting out the show today, the book is about 825 pages. I got the book this week, and I'm through 30 pages of it. And
all right,
and it's really fun, and I'm enjoying it very much. And I like John's science fiction, or I should say Victor's science fiction, since he.
What do you think of the Pleiadian dancing girls?
Well, I don't want to give much away, but there's a little bit for everybody in the first 30 pages.
I tried to make it, I'll warn people, it's not for the faint-hearted. It is a story from a war zone.
And there are no pictures. It's 825 real pages.
There's a picture on the cover.
Oh, there's a picture on. Now, is that Cassandra on the cover?
That's Cassandra on the cover.
Okay, so, and if you're going to search for it, remember, you're not going to find it under John Brandenburg. The author's name is Victor Norgaard, Norgarde, and he writes that way so the scientific community won't throw him out.
Well, it's based on ufology, which is, I complained to a friend of mine who is a UFO guy, and I said, his name's Don Ecker, and he's a really smart guy, and I said, "Don, the problem with this whole field is there are no facts." Much less data. There's no facts.
Before we
it's
add
all stories and rumors and you know, a few fuzzy pictures, and I said, I can't as a scientist really do anything with that. So as a science fiction writer, however, I can do something with that.
You have another serious question before we end the show, because we're over 2 hours.
Thank you for letting me go over. I will just say that the UFO novel that has just come out is my best guess, based on somebody who worked closely with the military and everything, as what this scenario would look like, a UFO war.
Okay. Here, Fremont John has another one for you.
All right.
John Kim Holder's Moonward. Kim is a lady who called from Mexico a little while ago. Kim Holder's Moonward scenario envisions routine use of nuclear shuttles at many years from now, not knowing when. Uh-huh. Since the current political environment will likely prohibit developing and launching nuclear rockets from Earth, does it make sense to set up robotic infrastructure for in-situ processing of thorium and construction of nuclear rockets on the moon?
Yes. My own, in my particular fiction, they use helium-3, they master helium-3 fusion and gravitic, you know, gem, M-drive. So they kind of bypass the big fission rocket. But we are definitely going to have, nuclear powered spacecraft, especially towards the end of the novel, are very common, human nuclear powered spacecraft.
And you think that'll be for real too, Simon?
Yes, I do. I believe in terms of the technology, the technological progression, the technological accomplishments of the human race, especially by the end of the novel, I believe those will be prophetic. Hopefully we can avoid a war with our neighbors.
Guys, gals, listeners, and Dr. B, I got a call the other day from someone I know who I am not at liberty to talk about yet, but he may be coming on the show. And it's about progress being made on nuclear propulsion, and it was regarding what's going on with research at various places around the country, including the Idaho National Lab. He wanted to know if I was still interested in doing a show about nuclear, and of course I jumped up and down and did 30 jumping jacks and said yes. I sent him information and the typical invite, and I'm waiting for him to work it through channels to get permission to come on, because as John has alluded to earlier, so much of what is going on is classified, or the other side of that is people who know the facts about all of these kinds of things have all sorts of security classifications. And to come on the radio and talk freely may be a big risk to them, because for all they know, they could say something thinking it's not classified and it still is, and then they get in a S-load of trouble for that, which is different from speaking about a lecture at a conference, because that is far more of a controlled environment than a freewheeling radio show. So this is why it is so hard to get nuclear bomb people for real to come on the show and talk about John's theories for nuclear explosions, because they still have security clearances, and they're still sworn by oaths and things they did years ago, even though they're retired, and they don't know what's classified and declassified anymore.
I can only talk about it because I was basically told, go ahead and publish this.
But not everybody has that.
Everyone was told that.
So my contact is running it through channels to get permission to do this, and I recognize that it's a real problem, and I don't try to combat it. I'm not critical of it at all, and I don't want to put anybody at risk for what they say on the space show, unless they're just dumb morons and they deserve to be at risk.
I have been at conferences where people have really spoken out of school and gotten tremendous blowback for it. They said stuff at the conference that they shouldn't have said in public, and they had a dump truck full of manure come and dump itself on them.
I have talked to many people in the nuclear weapons field, and I have shown them John's PowerPoint that he delivered at AIAA and some other things. And they say, you know, without their doing their own research and everything, John is right on target. But I'm not going to come and talk to you because
they can't talk about it.
Because even though I'm retired, I don't know if what I might slip or say is still covered by something I took an oath on 10 years ago, and it's still classified, so I simply can't do it. And
I can talk about it because I was never read into those programs, and the people I talked to said, go ahead and publish. So.
So anyway, that's all I know. Now, Fremont John, and this is going to be the last question of the day,
said
helium-3 fusion is still science fiction. What about current nuclear NERVA technology? Well, John, if you stay tuned with us and the guys come on who are talking to me about it now, you will get current, up-to-date, factual information.
I'll just say I love the whole NERVA program. I think it should go forward. In my novel, they figure out how to do helium-3 fusion and make it compact.
Okay.
So they can power spacecraft with it.
Any closing comments you want to give us?
I don't think we're alone in the universe, and we'll just have to reconcile ourselves to that, with all that that entails. But it means the universe is a complicated place.
But do you think we're our neighbors are nice folks, or some of them are bad?
Some of them are not. You know, it's like any big town.
Do they look
like? Somebody asked me what the universe is like, and I was on an LA talk show, and I said the universe is like Los Angeles, and they said, "Oh no."
Will there be real life Cassandras and Pams?
Yes, there will be.
For us to meet?
Yes, there will be.
Okay, well, let's hurry up the process.
Okay.
Anything else?
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
When you finish, will your presentation that you're going to make at the aerospace,
sure,
will it be online or will it be public?
I'm not going to present anything I haven't kind of presented, sort of. It'll look a lot like what I presented at the space conference,
Which
is online. There'll be some new herbs and spices added, but basically it'll just be what was presented at the space conference in 2015 or 2016, rather.
All right. We will look forward to talking to you down the road. And,
okay, Dave. Great privilege.
And if I can work something out with Heidi and Woodward's lab and everything, I'll get back to you on that because I'd really like to
we'll
do it.
We'll explore that.
Thank you for being with us. And listeners, the real title of his book, To Rule the Night, The UFO War, Not in Kansas Anymore, and the author name is Victor Norgaard, N-O-R-G-A-R-D-E, book 2 of the Morningstar UFO Trilogy on Amazon and elsewhere. Everybody have a great weekend coming up. Open Lines is on Sunday. We'd love to have you call us more than we'd love to have you email us, so keep that in mind. And a special thanks to Victor Norgaard for telling us about his book, to Dr. John Brandenburg for telling us about everything else. And thank you from my heart for listening to the show today. And everybody, as I said, great weekend. Keep it safe. Keep looking up. Goodbye from John, from Victor, David, and the Space Show.